Welcome to another episode of The Suspendables with funny man Jungle Jim Jerome and retired NHL star Russ Cortinel.
Here's Cortinel. He scores! Cortinel's
feeding it! Each week they unleash their raw, stripped-down, unfiltered opinions on all things hockey and maybe other stuff too. Who knows? Inside stories, absolutely. Outrage, guaranteed. Offside, for sure. And always plenty of laughs. Strap in. The Suspendables is coming at you right now.
Okay. Have yourself a very merry Christmas. May your heart be bright. It's December.
How are you?
I'm good, Rusty. I'm good. Yeah, I'm getting over the sting.
It's the breakup. You got punted.
Yeah, I did. I did. So I took up walking. Okay, so I've been walking every day.
Stalking.
Okay, it's not stalking. Yeah, I walked 35 miles to her front door. Yeah. No, I didn't. Anyway, we got another great show coming up. Lots of stuff to talk about. It was the week of exhibition events, Russ. Mm-hmm. Okay, Stephon Curry took on Phil Mickelson, and terrible, Charles Barkley. You had that deal going on. You had the Mike Tyson. He fought Jones Jr. there, okay, in some deal they tried to throw together. You had the undercard of that was some YouTube sensation kid named Jake Paul took on. Now, this makes a bunch of sense, Russ. Took on three-time NBA dunk champion Nate Robinson. Mm-hmm. That sounds like it makes sense, doesn't it? They're going to box, okay? That's what they did. Bigger than all those stories, Russ, Mark Mayhew was the guy who gave me my break in radio. It started in Ottawa. I got invited on to sit in to do morning shows and afternoon shows at a place called Ottawa Sports Radio at the time. And then I loved it. I did it for like 3 or 4 months straight. I thought this is the deal. And then the station got sold. I came in one morning and everyone's freaking crying. And I'm going, oh, well, that was a good ride. And then I got offered this morning show job by Mark, who was working for the Chum family. And then I started doing morning radio, Russ. Okay. That was my big break. And I love Mark.
That was a great gig for you because you just came right from the bar to the radio station. And then when you went home to bed after the show.
Not only that, Russ, and I know Mark's listening. We'll bring him on in a sec. Not only that, Russ, most guys would be on time if you're out all night. Okay.
Yeah.
If you're out all night, it's like, okay, I got to be on air at 5:30. It's 5 after 5. I got to leave the bar. But I would be late still after being out all night. Oh. Anyway, I remember, so we did this show. It was great. And I went in, I got to, Mark scalped me on a deal over lunch. Okay. I left a bunch of money on the table. And then he said, you're a part of the show. And so then I started going to my head, Russ. Right. And I walk into, so I've been doing it a month or two. And I walk into Mark's office. I said, you got a minute, Mark? Absolutely, Jimmy. Open door, whatever you need. And I said, listen, Mark, it's about time I start to think of which demographic should I be going after? How should I adjust what I say? What are we looking at here, Mark? And how can I? And he goes, get the fuck out of my office. he says, you just let us know about those voices that are going on in your head. Okay.
Yeah.
You just spew that over the mic and we'll look after the rest there big time. Okay.
Yeah. See anyway, what I'm dealing Mark's, with, Mark? Oh my God.
Mark is here. And I thought it would be interesting to bring on Mark because he was the golden boy for Bell Globe Media and Chum and has spent his whole life in media on all levels, from on air to production to general manager to sales. And I thought, Russ, there's a lot of big numbers floating around in media all the time when we hear about rights fees and ratings games and how many, how do they do it and all this dough. Okay. For example, the Rogers deal. Okay. For the NHL, Russ, that they signed $5.2 billion deal over 12 years, the NBA or the NCAA, Russ. Okay. Does a deal with CBS for $8.8 billion.
Jeez.
So I'm going, what does all that mean? Okay. And, Mark, you're there. Mark, you're listening to this way. I'm breaking it down perfectly, aren't I? Really?
Yeah.
The Suspendables sure. $2.2.
Yeah, that's right. But, so we want to talk about a bunch of that stuff with you, Mark, but, and maybe you can weigh in on some of this other stuff. You can be like a guest host. Okay. On some of this stuff. The golf deal, Russ, obviously this is a stretch. Russ and Mark. This is a stretch to come up with some idea to fill airtime with sports fans and people. And so they do the Phil Mickelson, Charles Barkley against, I'll get this right now, Stephen Curry and
Peyton Manning.
Yeah. I didn't watch a second of it, Russ. I think it's stupid. I think it's worth nothing but someone making some cash. And
it was for charity, numbnuts. Oh. Fuck, you're a beauty.
Well, still.
Now, how do you feel?
Well, still.
Four huge names gave their time to raise a bunch of money. All the money went to black colleges and
whatever.
Help out. Yeah. Well, okay. They didn't take any money.
It's a beautiful deal. A beautiful deal.
They're okay. Giving back.
Now, it's a beautiful deal that they're doing, but no, you can't have Charles Barkley playing golf against two other guys who don't play golf, and one guy's a really good golfer. It just doesn't make sense.
Actually, Peyton and Stefan are pretty good.
Well, but they're not. It's a dumb idea anyway.
Oh wow, okay.
I think you're confusing, you know, the event with sports, and it's not really sports. It's entertainment. And that's what it's designed to do. And it's a charity fundraiser, and it's going to attract sports fans. But, you know, when you have Charles Barkley golfing, it's hardly professional sports, right? It's a spectacle. It's fun and it's interesting for people who are into that sort of thing. But, you know, don't confuse it with sports. The Roy Jones Jr. Mike Tyson fight, that's a money grab. These guys, you know, well, they want some notoriety, but a lot of it's money. And Tyson's money woes are well documented, and nothing against it. The guy can still fight and people will pay to see him. But that's all that is.
I don't know how it was $50 or something to.
They fought to a draw, you know, so it sets up a rematch and another payday and the wheel keeps turning.
Mark, exactly. It's like 1 hour a week. We normally work on Sundays. Just check your schedule.
Okay, one of these things you guys are going to agree is stupid. What about the slam dunk champ boxing the YouTube sensation guy? And he knocked him out. Okay, that was one of the events.
It's a spectacle.
I'd love to see you in there, Rusty.
No way. Last fight I was in, I won by freaking 5 blocks.
Yeah. Okay, what about the girl? Bringing the girl on. What about this story as an exhibition event?
Well, here's the
bad move.
Oh, no, well, hang on a second. My daughter, Allie, kicked a field goal, you know, 50 yards in her senior year at high school at fun practicing. And there's always that, can the girls kick? And we jokingly say when somebody misses in the NFL, Allie would have made that. And so I think it was time to see, you know, throw a girl in there and see what they can do. Having two daughters who play soccer and can kick the shit out of the ball, I don't see what's wrong with it. I think it's a bit dangerous, but it puts to bed maybe some theory on can the girls do it. But I don't think there's a problem in having a kicker who's a female out there if they can boot the hell out of the ball. Unfortunately, she didn't boot it very well.
Well, your daughter kicked
50.
She kicked a football 50 or kicked a soccer ball?
No, football.
Unreal.
50 yards,
wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is impressive.
And on her Instagram, she kicked one at Minnesota Vikings Training Center. I think it was like 30 or 35 in her sneakers just about 2 months ago.
Isn't that cool?
In street clothes.
Wow. Yeah. That's awesome.
Maybe she could put your head on the tee the next time.
Jimmy. Oh,
I'm killing me here.
Well, listen, you know, like the that's really the only position a woman could play on a football team. And, you know,
agreed.
Play it effectively and well. It, much like Manuel Raume did in the NHL, you know, you could be a goalie, I guess, because the amount of physical contact is minimal, you know, because women just aren't going to be able to compete with men in those sports. But, you know, the real test would be if you want to make a play for equality, and if you want to play that card, great, it's awesome, then start her in a game. Yeah. Don't bring her in at halftime when the game is out of hand, you know. Just tell everybody in advance we're starting her this week and, you know, she's ready to go and she's playing the whole game. And then that's different. You know, this sounds a little opportunistic, but, you know, hey, listen, it's a step in the right direction. It's interesting.
Yeah. And social media is mean, man. They're going to, I haven't looked, you know, they're going to take this thing down. You know, they're going to take it down. There was a bunch of downside to it in my mind. and not a bunch of upside, you know.
Did you guys see the Raome interview? I think, was that back in 93, 94 when she was on Letterman? Was that about the time she got called up to?
That's try? About the time, Russ. Yeah. I didn't see the interview, though.
Oh, it's such a great interview. She's on Letterman. And she goes, I've never seen you. I don't know who you are. And I've never watched your show in Quebec. We watch French speaking TV. And sorry, I don't know who you are. And it was so cute. I just loved that. I was laughing so hard. It was so great. And it was so honest and natural. And he was loving it. Like, you know, can you imagine David Letterman? And
well, sure.
Beautiful girl comes on and she's in the NHL and she goes, I've never heard of you.
Perfect for Letterman. I think it was Espo, Phil Esposito, wasn't he? It was Tampa, right? That she dressed Tampa Bay Lightning, suited up for you.
More of a publicity stunt. They couldn't sell peanuts to starving monkeys down there at that time in terms of tickets. Right. So they needed to do anything they could to generate some interest, and that certainly got some play.
Yeah.
You know, all that stuff, this Sarah Fuller coming on to kick for Vanderbilt, and you talk about Raome doing that. It all goes back to the battle of the sexes. And the original thing, because I was talking about it a few weeks ago with Stevie, the original one was Bobby Riggs was going to play Billie Jean King. I don't know if you're old enough to remember that, Russ. And that's how it kind of started. And it had a massive viewership for that thing, but... Anyway, I think some of this stuff is a stretch, some of these exhibition things. Now, all that being said, Russ, talking about exhibition events, you were part of one when you entered the Battle of the Blades.
For our listeners in the United States, it's like Dancing with the Stars. It was a big deal in Canada. It was the number one rated show, actually, in Canada. And they pulled it for, and I think it's back on now, but you get eight retired hockey players and eight professional figure skaters who've been in the Olympics. And so I got a call from Christine Simpson asking me if I would do the show. She'd happened to be at Gretzky Fantasy Camp that year and she was helping get players. So she went back to Toronto and mentioned my name and they called or she called and I said, yeah. And then before I knew it, I was in this thing and I was like, oh my God, I don't know how to figure skate. I had to learn how to figure skate. Because the skates are totally different. It is so serious because you don't want to embarrass yourself. You're in front of a live audience on Sunday night in Toronto, 3,000 people in the audience. And then it's live across Canada. I think there's a tape delay for the East Coast or maybe the West, can't remember, but it's mostly live. And it was nerve-wracking as hell. And I really enjoyed it because it was so difficult to learn and something I'd never thought I'd do. And each guy, I mean, we were all so proud of one another. We were competing, but we were cheering each other on because we were so amazed we were actually doing it. Mm-hmm. And another fundraiser for each person got to pick a charity and it was great. I really, really enjoyed it.
How much prep, Russ, when you got the call and you decided to do it, how much time leading up to it did you work on this thing? And how did all that work? How did you spend your days?
So what they said to make it for TV, they asked all of us not to buy skates. They said, we'll give you your skates when you get to the training camp in July or August. I think it was August. Mm-hmm. And they wanted to show on TV how hard it is and, you know, us falling down and the beginning and the buildup. So I took that to heart. I actually listened and showed up. Val Bure and I never touched the skates. A couple of guys, like I think Chaser, PJ, PJ and
PJ Stock,
Theo Fleury, they had skated, so they looked pretty good, and the rest of us just looked like hell. And anyways, we all. So you skate you have a training camp for a week and then they decide who you're going to pair up with. And then you go home and you start practicing. Like I spent 28 hours of public skating, learning how to not fall down and skate on these figure skates. And that's 28 hours. The reason I know it was 28 hours is because my daughter and I went 14 times to a 2-hour public skate here in LA.
Right.
And it took me 28 hours before I was confident that I wasn't going to fall on my face.
So when they say skates, are they have the picks on the end of them and all that stuff?
Yeah. And the difference is with hockey players, we skate on our toes and they skate on the balls and heels of their feet. So they push with the ball of their feet and their heel and lift your toes. Actually, they always say, lift your toes when you push. And with hockey, you dig in. And none of us knew that. And obviously you learn in a hurry because as soon as you stick your, when you go to push with your toe, then you fall on your face. So it was something.
Who was your partner?
Christine Huff Sweeney.
Anyway, Christine, that's pretty Huff. Cool. I mean, it was way more serious than I thought.
Well, you didn't want to embarrass yourself. It was, you know, the first year I did it twice. I got axed right away because they have two of the, it's a vote, right? So the fans vote in, and it was me and Bure, and he was freaking with Katarina. I don't know.
Fit.
Yeah, like two-time gold medalist. And my partner, she's like, oh, we're going to lose. And I'm like, no, we got this. And sure enough, we got voted off. Brett Hall was the judge, and he's like, sorry, there's nothing I can do. There's no way. He goes, I can't. Russ, you're my friend. You can't. I mean, come on. She's two-time champion.
A reminder, you can follow The Suspendables on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. And check out our new website, thesuspendables.ca.
Bunch of shout-outs to people, to Clayton and Lynn and Chris Newell, who's a buddy of mine from Sudbury, whose uncle was Dave Newell. Remember the ref? Russ,
yeah,
probably ref when you did.
Probably had a couple fuck you fights with him.
Yeah. I'm sure I'll take Dave Newell. He's slightly crazier than you are. I know him. Yeah. Aaron Parker, thanks a lot. And Adam Henry and Brent Gorman, Stan Bifford. I want to read a couple of posts, Russ, uh-oh, to you. No, they're nice, Russ. I pick all the nice ones. And then we got to talk to Mike. Hey, Jim, a fan of the podcast. It has entertained me for many hours while I travel for work. A colleague from Vancouver recommended another podcast. I barely made it through the first show, Russ.
Right? Oh, wow.
That means they're talking about the Chicklets, I'm sure, right? They're talking about the...
Well, there's a few shows out there.
Yeah. You were on another one.
Yeah.
You cheated. You're having an affair.
Yeah. It was good.
Anyway, he says that one doesn't even compare to The Suspendables. As we sit here in self-isolation, I miss watching my beloved Flames and yelling at the TV as they went through their roller coaster season. Sportsnet just replayed game 6 from the 1989 finals, Russ. Curious what Russ thought as he sat in the penalty box after running over Vernon when Gilmore scored the game winner. Didn't look like Russ made any attempt to avoid Vernon.
I purposely hit him because we were losing, and I told Pat Burns, I said, next shift I go out there, I'm going to run the goalie. And I was trying to just mix it up and stir it up and try to. So if you know, I dumped it the other way, went down the right side, and Vernon had to come out, and then he was screwed because I could run him over. And then they came after me, but I ended up getting the penalty, and we lost that game, but we were losing the series, and I was just trying to change it up and try to get some momentum on our side. And then we, Claude Lemieux scored after that. And then we just fell short. I mean, they won 4-2. We were up 2-1 and we ran out of gas in that series and they got stronger and beat us. We should have won. And unfortunately we didn't.
Is Vernon a buddy of yours?
Yeah. Vernie and I are buddies. We've never really talked about it. You know, it's one of those things that it's like Jim, you're the only one when you go through a breakup, we actually bring it up because it's funny. But when you do something like that to a player, you know, I'm not going to bring it up and he hasn't. So I'm not going to say, hey, remember when I ran you over?
Right.
Like, what would you like to drink?
Yeah. Or like,
so, no, we've never talked about it. No. And maybe he forgot about it. Maybe. I mean, he was lifting the cup about freaking 15 minutes later. He probably forgot about it.
Right. You know, when a guy gets divorced, right? It happens all the time, right? Yeah. People get divorced. And one of my funniest lines ever was the guy said, you know, because they were, oh, not Bob. And, yeah, they got divorced, Bob and Sandra. Yeah, they did. And the buddy says, me and my wife were going to get divorced, but nobody wanted custody of the kids. Right? But you told me a long time ago, because you hear about a guy gets divorced, then you run into him and you go, hey, buddy, how's it going? Right. And you always said, never ask a guy how your divorce is going, ever, ever,
ever.
Like I taught you last week. I phoned you. We were shooting the shit, and you started fighting with your wife about politics.
Yeah.
Looks edgy around your house, Russ.
No, we're good.
You're okay.
We can't have a normal conversation. So if she wasn't an actor, she should have been a lawyer, because you can't win. You just can't. She's just going to argue to the – she's like her and Allie, my oldest daughter, debaters. They just wear you down and wear you down until you go, okay – Uncle,
I've had enough.
I've had enough. All right. All right. Witness number 32.
That's funny. Here's another letter, Russ, I want to read, and then we got to talk to Mark. Russ says here, from the bottom of our hearts, me and my family want to thank you for your support and unwavering loyalty, and we can never thank you enough. That's Bob, the manager of the Westlake Liquor Store. Your unwavering support, Russ. Mark, we got to bring you in. Thanks a lot for joining us, by the way, Mark, on the show. And thanks for hiring me way back when you did. It's allowed for this sort of stuff and allowed me to meet a bunch of people. But you're an expert in the field, if not one of the top guys in the country. You're certainly close about the media business and the radio game. You spent your whole life, didn't you, Mark, in the radio game?
Yeah. I started when I was 18, and I just turned 60 not that long ago. So it's a lot of years.
What's happening with radio? Is it a dying thing, or is it?
No, radio is always going to be around, Jimmy. And you know, if you can go back through the history of media and always see and read about the different things that were going to kill radio. You know, radio was huge in the 30s and 40s, and then color movies was going to kill radio, and then in the early 50s, it was television was going to kill radio, and then cassette tapes was going to kill radio, and, recordable television programs was going to kill radio and cable TV. It never happened. And radio is special because, for the most part, it's local. And if you're doing things on the radio that cannot be duplicated on the internet, if you're really doing interesting live programming that's entertaining and informing people, you're always going to find an audience. The only problem now is that there's so much competition for advertising dollars. And radio is 100% supported by advertising. So, back in the day, you didn't have Google and Amazon and Facebook and all these digital companies that are just hoovering up every advertising dollar out. And they're taking some of it from radio. And the more they take from radio, the less money the industry has to create that kind of compelling local content that keeps them, relevant and important. So, radio's at a crossroads right now. It has to decide in the middle of a pandemic as well, how it's going to write its next 100 years. It just celebrated its 100th anniversary this past year. So commercial radio. So, going forward, I think you're going to see a slimmed down radio, but you're still going to see great, compelling live programming do well. And a lot of that programming is sports. Because the great thing about sports and sports talk on radio is it can't be duplicated. If two guys or two people are talking about sports on the radio, nobody else anywhere in the world is doing that exact same thing at that exact same time. So if you live in Philadelphia and you want to talk about, you want to hear guys talk about the Philadelphia Eagles or how bad the 76ers are this year or how the Phillies are doing, that's why you're going to come to the radio station.
So, Mark, if radio was big, bigger than it is now, I get what you're saying. It's certainly here to stay, but it's got to be less of a revenue stream for a bunch of companies than it was.
Yeah, it is. Well, the radio has gone through a lot of consolidation. So, you've got companies that have been buying up other companies. So, the players in the business are much bigger than they were before.
Right.
And so when you consolidate like that, you get economies of scale. So you can protect your margins by aggregating a bunch of stations together. You only need one accounting department for a corporation. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? No matter how many stations you have. So you know, those kinds of costs help economies of scale help keep your margins, you know, healthy. But you can't save your way into long-term profitability. And the key for radio, you know, before we move on to this other stuff, is really they've got to find new revenue sources. They've got to find, you know, some blue ocean areas for advertising that haven't used radio before and traditionally have not used radio, and go talk to them and start selling them time. Because a lot of the traditional advertisers are finding that they're still using radio. They're just using a lot less of it because they have so many other choices. Like, they can advertise on your show. You know, your particular podcast reaches a certain type of sports fan and a certain type of talk fan. And that wasn't around a couple of years ago. And whatever you're going to get for the advertising in your show is going to come from somewhere. And likely it's going to come from an advertiser who is spending a little bit of money on sports radio in some markets. Right. And they're going to find it more effective to use your product. So it's a challenge, but, you know, it's a challenge radio is certainly up to. There's a lot of smart people in the business, and we'll figure it out.
So let's look at some of these astronomical rights deals that it's hard to believe when I say the numbers, but I've heard them my whole life. And Russ has heard them, and I sort of just go, isn't that crazy? It's a multi-billion-dollar deal. And then I kind of walk away. And then once in a while I go, okay, how can this thing be in the billions? How is anyone making money? How does this all break down? Who figures out, for example, Mark, that a Rogers deal, okay, was it a 12-year deal? And it's $5.2 billion that Rogers paid the NHL. There's nothing obvious about that one, Mark, for me. There's nothing there. I don't know about you, Russ, when you hear that. And you deal with money all the time, Russ, in real estate and stuff. And I'm going, okay, I need some help with this.
Well, so the first thing about the Rogers deal for the NHL, it was a huge deal. And I think it certainly caught TSN napping. I was working for Bell Media at the time when that deal happened. And it was, you know, the shot heard around the world when the word came out that Bell Media had been shut out of the NHL rights. It was like the funeral was about to begin, and everybody at Rogers was celebrating. Interesting to note, though, the two guys who did that deal at Rogers, Keith Felly and I think it was Nadir Mohammed, the CEO, they both left shortly after that deal got done, because that deal, as great as it was from an industry point of view to put Rogers, you know, right on top, and was bragging rights, it didn't take very long for the chickens come home to roost, because at that kind of cost, you just cannot make money. Mm-hmm. It's not only the $5.232 billion rights deal, which works out to about $420 million a year in Canada.
And that's what, you're stroking that check, Mark, and that's all you're getting is the rights.
Yeah, you're getting the rights to broadcast the game. So let's round it up. Let's round it down to $430 million Canadian a year that Rogers has to pay the NHL. Okay? So that's the check you stroke for the right to broadcast the game. Now, every other cost on top of that is on Rogers. They have to hire all the people. Okay? Right. They've got to build studios. They've got to create programming around hockey, which costs money. All the infrastructure behind putting hockey on the air, which is a tremendous expensive endeavor, is also a cost on top of the rights fees. So, you know, there's money in hockey for sure, and it is Canada's passion. But there is a limit to what it can support. And you've seen over the course of the past few years, Rogers has really, like many other broadcasters, started to trim back and cancel some shows, cancel some programming, lay some people off, and start to really try to get their costs in line, because bragging rights are one thing, but these things have to show a profit. And they have to have margins equivalent to the other products and services that in their portfolio. And, you know, the hockey deal has not turned out to be as good a deal as they thought it would be. And you know, last year alone, just in the sheer volume of money, in the United States last year, $21 billion was spent on sports television rights just in the U.S. $21 billion.
Wow.
Well, I'm spending $200 tonight on the Seahawks.
So, you know, you've got national, you got national rights, you've got regional rights, you've got radio rights, you've got local rights for all these different sports. And, you know, it certainly helped hockey, like the NHL, you know, you got to give Gary Bettman a lot of credit because he knew how to work both sides of that deal. He knew that Bell Media and CBC was bowing out. They made it very clear they weren't going after the rights. So it was Bell Media and Rogers, and he worked both sides of that and got a great deal for the NHL. As you know, the NFL has done a great job of maximizing what they're worth. You know, they're getting in the neighborhood of just over $6 billion a year, the NFL television rights from Fox, CBS, ESPN, and NBC. Like, unreal. When you divide that up between 32 teams, and that's the check each franchise is getting every year because they split everything evenly, right? Mm-hmm. And that, in turn, those great rights deals that are funded by advertising and viewership are driving up the value of these franchises, mm-hmm. which is also important because in some cases, you know, a lot of the value in a franchise is in the increased asset value of the franchise. Some franchises and some sports make money some years, don't make money other years. Right. But in the end, the net asset value of the team keeps growing because mm-hmm. of what's supporting it, these rights deals. So, you know, Jerry Jones, the story I like to tell is he bought that team, the Dallas Cowboys, which is considered the most valuable team in sports. Jerry Jones bought that team in 1989 from Tex Schramm.
Yeah.
The number's disputed, but somewhere between 140 and 150 million. Let's call it $150 million.
Right.
Last year, the Dallas Cowboys were valued at $5.5 billion.
Jeez. And he tells that story. He was losing, the interest alone was $1 million a month or something like that?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. And it was all he could do to kind of keep this thing afloat. But, you know, he's one of those guys. He's a great visionary.
Mm-hmm.
He's loud and he's brash, and you know some people don't like him. I love him from the standpoint of he's the biggest promoter of his business. He loves his business. Whether you agree with how he runs it and gets his hands dirty and stuff, that's another thing. But he just loves his business, promotes his business, and he's done an excellent job for the NFL. And every owner in the NFL, you're part of a. It's almost like a bit of a you know a cartel in the fact that they decide who gets in. And they also decide what franchises are worth. Nobody's selling a franchise for less than they paid for it.
He's the, sorry, Mark, keep going.
No, go ahead, Russ.
I was going to say he's the Steve Jobs of the NFL. Steve Jobs of the founder of Apple. I mean, listening to him talk in 1997 when I was in the off season, when he took over the company again and everything he said, I was like, is that really possible? And everything he said came true.
Yeah,
our phones absolutely. Are going to be our credit cards. Our phones are going to have they're going to have recording systems. They're going to have cameras. They're going to have your computer. Everything he said was on there. And Jerry Jones, he has done so many great things to promote the sport and the things he's look at now. Everyone's trying to build the same building he built. That opened a few years ago, and now he's built this huge park and he's hosting games there. High school games, he's built more things that have just increased the value on top of just the value of the franchise. He's done all these incredible things. And I had the pleasure of meeting him in Dallas when I played for the Stars, and he's a legend. And when he walks in the room, everybody knows he's there.
Kind of has the Peter Pocklington reputation because he's like a bloodhound, you know, he's got his nose up there going, I smell cash over here.
And he's Peter Pocklington with money.
With cash. Other than that, they're identical, you know. But I think Jerry Jones, too, was the first guy to, he said, I know. What do you mean we have closed practices? Open them up and charge $25 a head or something or even more. Okay, so all this is fair enough, Mark. So I'm getting to understand that the value of each franchise, of course, is just going up and up and up. So I get the sense that a guy goes, fuck, I don't know, just buy it. And in 10 years from now, it's going to be 10 times as much money. However, the problem with that, Mark, that I see is it's my understanding, Mark, that the viewership and the amount of people watching sports right now is going down. is going down. And because of the younger generation, it's all people like, you know, the ratings for the Masters is all, you know, their biggest viewership is over 50 years old. You know, curling is getting higher, like 60 year old. Mm-hmm. I do that curling podcast, so we talk about it quite a bit. And the younger generation, Mark, is gaming now. Everyone agrees, Mark, you want to do anything, you got to get the young people involved.
You do. And listen, you know, the NHL had to wrestle with this to try to bring young people back interested in the game on TV. And that has kind of dictated how the production value of TV broadcasts go. They're quick moving. There's rock music. There's hip hop music in it now. Look at the NBA, the way they produce games. They're trying to get younger people to make this part of their culture and make this part of their habit. But the fact of the matter is, you know, TV ratings for sports in general this year are down. Mm-hmm. They're down anywhere between, you know, the NFL's down about 13%. Mm-hmm. Some sports are down, you know, like the NHL Stanley Cup finals were down 61%. You know, they got whacked.
Right.
The Masters was way down. The NBA finals was down almost 50%. Part of it is, you know, the COVID situation is not helping. People's routines and habits and patterns are totally out of whack, as are the time of the year that the sports are happening. Nobody's used to watching the Masters in November. You know, we're kind of programmed that, you know, Father's Day is the U.S. Open. You know, the second weekend in April, it's the Masters. And, you know, Stanley Cup finals are always in June, you know, and that's kind of how we organize things, and we kind of plan our watching around those things. But that's all changed this year. The general trend, even without the COVID, is the fact that TV viewership is starting to fall off. And part of it is there's a lot of choice out there. There's more choice of what you can watch on a screen now than there ever has been before. And all these over-the-top options are all kind of nibbling in around the edges. It's a share point here. It's a share point there. And all of a sudden, you know, when you used to have a 16 share, now all of a sudden you've got a 14 share or 13.5. And it just kind of eases down that way. There's just more choice. Attention spans are getting shorter. That's the internet too. It's Facebook, it's Instagram. So when a football game is 3 hours, you know, they're doing everything they can to speed these games up. Same with the NHL. Same with baseball. It's had this problem for a long time. Attention spans of younger viewers are getting shorter and shorter.
Right.
And then you've got things like gaming, which is becoming increasingly popular, especially with 18 to 24 men. And 18 to 24 men is an important demographic today for the future of sports like the NBA, the NFL, and the NHL.
Right, right.
And if you don't get in the habit of watching these sports on TV early and often and regularly, it's going to manifest itself in lower average minute audiences down the road. And it's starting to happen now.
I got a story about watching a game with a 25-year-old, let's call him 25. So not last summer, the summer before, I'm up at Gozer, and my buddy, I'm trying to find the Vikings game because Mark, my daughter, her boyfriend is Eric Kendricks, number 54, plays for the Vikings. So I'm trying to watch the game. I can't get the game. My buddy from Calgary, who has a cottage there, says, I got the game. Come up and watch it. So I get on the couch. I'm sitting there. I put the remote to my right. This kid sits down. He walks in. He's not even living at the house. He's a guest of the neighbor, sits beside me, grabs the remote. And my buddy Wyatt says, yeah, Russ is here to watch the Vikings game. So we got the Vikings. After every play, he was switching it to another game. And I never heard the broadcast, nothing. And I wanted to punch this fucking guy in the head and then kick him in the nuts. I was so pissed off. It was driving me, and I had nowhere else to go. There was no other place to watch the game. And I was given facial expressions and eyes, and the guy never got the hint. And then finally in the second half, he left because his team was playing like shit, and he left. But the first half was a total waste of time. Oh my God. And I'm new to football, since Eric's been playing and college football and all that stuff. But it drove me freaking crazy because this guy was, and then he wanted to do like the divide the screens and have like eight games on at once. I'm like, oh my God, who is this guy?
Well, you know, what you're talking about, Russ, is analogous to what you know, we're kind of talking about is that attention spans are getting shorter and shorter. And that's why things like DirecTV Red Zone are so popular, because there are some people, and they tend to be gamblers, but they just want to watch Red Zone because they only want to see the action. They don't really want to watch a game, you know, 3 yards in a cloud of dust and go back to the huddle. They want to see constant scoring and action.
What is that, Mark? Sorry to interrupt. Explain what Red Zone is then.
Well, Red Zone is a DirecTV channel that basically just goes to every game in real time as a team is inside the 20-yard line, which is called the red zone in the NFL.
They call it
the red zone. So whenever a team is in the red zone or they're ready to score, they go to that game.
Brilliant.
So you're constantly seeing scoring chances and scoring opportunities on the screen. And it's hugely popular. But, you know, I mentioned gambling, and I say that more than passing. That's another part of what's driving, you know, viewership, fan loyalty, interest in professional sports. And Russ, you know, from living in the United States, there were a number of jurisdictions that after this last election that are now going to allow sports gambling in the state, in a number of states that didn't have it before. So it's propagating itself in more and more places where you can bet on sports. And when you do that, you bring more interest back to watching the sport on television, because people who bet on games have a vested interest in the outcome and they want to watch and they want to enjoy it. And that's part of how they get their thrill out of betting money on it, is by watching the game.
Right.
And if you've ever been to, you know, Vegas on a Sunday afternoon in a sports book when the NFL's on, or if you've ever been down like I have during March Madness, it's unbelievable. You know, the buzz and the action around a sports book when guys are betting money on sports.
A reminder, you can follow the Suspendables on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. And check out our new website, thesuspendables.ca.
So explain to me, Mark, one thing is how do we rate? How do they figure out ratings? How do they figure out a share jump in?
Jimmy, did you bring Mark on for our show? Are you trying to secretly find out how we can make money and get our ratings?
I've got this friend. He's got a show, like a podcast.
Yeah.
And, you know, how would you find out how many listeners you have?
Yeah. Everyone says, well, they got a 7% share.
Yeah.
And I'm going, how the fuck is a 7% share worth buying a league for $12 billion?
Measuring ratings is all about what you can charge for advertising. And, you know, that's why ratings are done, because, you know, advertising agencies that place ads in, you know, professional sports programs on American and Canadian television, they want to know what they're paying for. They want to know what they're getting. And the networks that are paying huge rights fees want to know if those rights fees are worth it. So, you know, they go to companies in Canada. The rating service is called Numeris. In the United States, it's Nielsen.
Yep.
And, you know, it's done in most markets, not in all markets, but in most major markets, the top 100 markets in the United States, the top 5 markets in Canada, it's all done through people meters. So there's a small device that's given to people who are selected as people in a panel that are going to, and these devices pick up what channel you're watching, and Numeris or Nielsen in this case in the United States knows, you know, you've told them who you are, how old you are, where you live and all that kind of stuff. And you carry this meter around with you, and this people meter keeps track of what you've been watching. And that data is then extrapolated. You represent however many people you represent. So they do a large enough sample that it's quote unquote statistically accurate. It's not that accurate, but it's all we've got. So, but it does give you a sense of how much tuning is being done, how many people are watching a given show, how long they watch it for, and, you know, what your audience, it's called AMA or average minute audience, how big your audience is at any given moment during a broadcast.
So Mark, if I'm paying $5 million, okay, if I'm a sponsor for a year and I pick up a season of the NBA or the women's basketball or whatever, and it's $5 million and it, and I'm getting a 7% share. Okay. Yeah. I'm investing my $5 million in a 7% share station. If it goes to 8%, Mark, how much is that going to cost me more than my $5 million the next year?
It doesn't. How it normally works is when you're doing a deal and you're buying sports, you're buying it based on a projected audience that the station or the network is going to guarantee. So they'll say, listen, we're charging you X number of dollars per spot, and we are going to deliver you an audience somewhere at a minimum of this to this.
Right.
And that's it. So if it's between this and this, that's what you're paying for. If it's less, then we owe you some compensation.
Oh, okay. So you get
if back. It's more, you got a great deal.
Oh, okay. Fair enough.
So that's why when, you know, games, you know, go into overtime or whatever, and you've got this huge audience waiting for an outcome. Sometimes as an advertiser, you get lucky and you got a spot in the right place at the right time.
Right.
It all evens out because sometimes you get really lousy placements as well. But, you know, when a program or a series or a game vastly under delivers, then the advertisers get compensated. And it's usually with extra bonus commercials in other programs. Rarely do they ever get any money back. It'll be, you know, we'll make up those rating points that we missed.
But it still must be big. And, you know, that when you're going to sell new advertising, it's obviously a new rate because now the share is 8% and not 7%.
And sometimes it's more than just the ratings, you know, like things like the Super Bowl has a certain cachet around it. So yeah, you're paying for the reach that you get because the Super Bowl numbers are huge, but being in the Super Bowl or having a commercial in the Super Bowl also brings you added notoriety. People are talking about you even before your commercial runs,
right?
Your commercial is being viewed in advance on the internet. It's being part of the top 10 best Super Bowl commercials, and it's on YouTube all over the place. There's a lot of extra added value, which is kind of baked into the ridiculously high prices that they charge and get, you know.
So. Right. So the last question, Mark, I have is all of this, when you're talking about billions and billions of dollars, and you brought up this $21 billion that are rights fees and sports properties alone, this to me it's begging for the two people who are sitting back watching this going, we're going to slaughter this. It's Amazon and it's got to be Apple who got to be looking at this saying, we're going to buy, you know what? We're going to buy 6 NFL teams. Okay. We're going to own 4 NBA teams. We're going to start our own station. You're going to be able to stream all of this shit, all of it on our station. It's got to be coming down the road somewhere.
Well, I think you're on the right track. I think it's more likely none of these sports leagues would ever want them to be owners. But I think what you may see happen in the not too distant future, and I think you hit it on the head. I think Amazon is a good prospect. So is Apple. I think Netflix is also somebody that can't be forgotten, and potentially Hulu. Is these over-the-top streaming services, what I mean is they're internet-based services that you subscribe to, they have an awful lot of money. Like Apple has an awful lot of money. Amazon has an awful lot of money. And there's going to come a time where one of them is going to say, you know what? We should go to the NFL and offer them a ridiculous amount of money, or the NBA, and offer them a ridiculous amount of money that they couldn't say no to, even if they wanted to say no, they can't say no. And we're going to buy a certain portion of those rights so that the only way you can watch these games is subscribe to Apple or subscribe to Amazon Prime or get a Hulu account. And I think that day's coming. You know, you saw it, for instance, in a very small way, go back to the radio where we started, Howard Stern. Howard Stern used to be on the radio in New York City, WXRK, a rock station in New York. And the FCC kept coming down on him all the time because he would say words like you and Russ say, and you're not allowed to say those on the radio over the air.
Gosh and darn.
Sirius XM came along and said, hey, listen, Howard, why don't you come and do satellite radio where you can say whatever you want, just kind of like a podcast. And people will pay, they'll pay money to listen to you do your show, which was an unheard of thing in radio. Nobody's going to pay to listen to a morning show.
Because radio is
free. Well, guess what?
Yeah.
Exactly. Guess what? A whole bunch of people lined up to pay $15 a month. 25 million people moved immediately to Sirius XM and paid $15 a month to hear the Howard Stern show. And wow. So a product, a premier product like that can bring people over. So imagine if Apple said, hey, listen, we're going to buy the NFL rights. The only way you can watch the NFL, or the only way you can watch 75% of the games on the NFL is here. And we're going to pay the NFL a ridiculous amount of money. We're going to pay them, I'm going to make this up. We're going to pay them $12 billion a year. So that may sound like a ridiculous amount of money, but all of a sudden, if that generates another 50 million subscriptions of Apple Music television at $15 a month, do the math. And that gets you into their ecosystem to buy computers and another phone and all sorts of other things that they want to do with you. So I think that day is coming, and Fox and ESPN, NBC, CBS, they're going to have other bidders out there.
Isn't that why Rogers did the deal, was to get more people into their phone subscriptions? And
the problem was the take-up wasn't as quick or as deep as they wanted it to be, or as they thought it would be. Streaming services like Apple and Netflix, you know, they've got the billions and billions and billions and billions of dollars to do this. And every year that goes by, the television networks have less money because their revenues are being impacted, just like radio, to a lesser degree, but they're being chipped away at by Google and by Facebook and others. There's not that, they're not the king of the media anymore. More money is spent on Google AdWords than on television.
You know, the positive of this might be is that if these tech companies come in and pay the owners this astronomical amount of money, you know what it might do is it might lower the cost of a ticket to go watch the game live. You know, because they're going to need people to come back to the games, and the ticket prices are getting so ridiculous. If they can maximize that deal, they can lower the ticket price and fill the stadiums.
It certainly gives them the flexibility to do that, Russ. And I think that's a really good point, because they are going to have to bring people back and keep people coming back. And if you can get them in with a relatively inexpensive ticket price, or an affordable ticket price where you can bring your kids and it's not going to break you, there's other ways to make money off people. You can make it on merch. You can make it on beer. You can make it on food or parking. But, you know, if you can lower the price of the ticket and that in-person experience, so you can't duplicate that. You know, it's at the cornerstone. You're watching the games in the bubble. They're great, but it's not the same without fans.
Right. When is Rogers going to start making money, Mark, on their $12 billion deal?
I think they're making some money, but they're just not making as much as they thought they were going to make. You know.
Before you go, then, I guess I've said this about three times before you go. What about podcasting? Where's it going? Talk about the podcast world. You're up to speed.
It's only going to get bigger. And you know, everybody with a microphone and a phone can be a podcaster. And I think the last number I saw is the median number of listeners podcasts have, I think, is 27. So there's a ton of podcasts with four listeners a week. Okay. Thousands and thousands and thousands of them. Unlike your podcast, that's extremely well listened to and shared by many.
Right.
And more people are discovering it every week because it's good. But that whole industry is really starting to explode. And you're going to see more specialization. You're going to see more interesting topics. You're going to see, I think, more celebrities start to do their own podcast, more familiar names. But I think, you know, what you guys are doing is one of those original kind of interesting podcasts. And I'm not saying that because I know you and you're my friend. I've said this from the day you told me you were going to do it. I think you go on there, you do a show in an honest way. It's authentic. It's real. You guys don't pull any punches. It's the real you. The way you do the show has probably cost you a little bit of money in terms of advertisers, because some advertisers are afraid to associate the product with a guy who's going to say fuck. You know, that's the way it goes. And Howard Stern had that same problem, right? But,
yeah.
You know, I'm not saying you have to be Howard Stern, but Howard Stern does a great show, and millions of people tune into it all the time because he's got great content. And I think you guys are well on your way. And podcasting itself is going to continue to really, really go. But you guys got in at a great time. And I would encourage you to continue to do what you do. Mm-hmm. Keep talking about interesting things and find ways to get more people to discover the show. That's the key. So if everybody listening right now, Russ, if everybody listening right now to this show would tell one friend about it that they know would like it, that they haven't done that yet, that would help everybody. Mm-hmm. Share it.
You want to hear my Howard Stern, Rick Dees story?
Absolutely. Yeah.
So Rick Dees taught me how to play golf back in the early 90s. And
the radio DJ, right?
Yeah, Rick Dees in the morning, weekly top 40. So Rick, we used to meet every Wednesday at Lakeside Country Club where he was a member. And we'd play golf after he'd do the weekly top 40 show. So he said, he was talking about his contract and this and stuff. And he said, Howard Stern really screwed up. He just left radio and he signed with this Sirius radio, this Sirius radio. I think that's it for Howard Stern. He's done.
That's funny, man.
Years later, Guy Johnson, who's a good friend of mine, was involved with Sirius radio. He actually was in charge of Canada, and he introduced me to the CEO, and he's a Victoria guy, hockey player, never made it to the NHL, good friend of mine. And I think he told me Howard Stern was making $100 million a year.
It's about 120 US.
Yeah.
120 million. Yeah.
How's it going, Howard? Yeah. How's it going?
You know, big mistake.
Boy, Rick Dees was bang on there. You know, it's funny, Mark, that you're on here because one of my favorite stories, because you came to Sherwood. I don't know if you remember this, Russ, but Wayne had a sort of an exclusive deal with where guys paid a whack of dough and he only had 18 groups to play golf. So it was only
one group. Wayne Gretzky, you know, Foundation Golf Tournament.
Right. And so Mayhew came down.
Yeah, I did it twice.
Yeah. And I remember you walking off the course one day and speaking of Rick Dees saying Howard made a huge mistake. And I will remember this forever because everyone's walking off the course for us after going, fuck, I played with Coach. He was in my celebrity. And I was with Kiefer Sutherland was in my group. And another guy was like, you know, I had Judd Nelson. And I remember Mayhew walking off the 18th green and going up to me going, I don't know what the fuck we had on earth. Okay. We got some Norton. This guy will never amount to anything. Some guy, Ryan Seacrest, something like that. Never heard of the guy. Do you remember that, Mark?
Yeah.
I mean, you probably weren't that animated, but you don't swear. But I remember you going, this guy's a nobody. I don't know. He has an afternoon show. And look where Ryan Seacrest is. He's bigger than all those guys.
I remember you and I, I was lucky enough to be with you and Jim Waters. And we got invited to Wayne's house for dinner.
Jimmy Waters is the Waters family who owned Chum. I'm guessing, have they sold out now, Mark? Is that all done?
They sold to CTV Bell Media.
Yeah, so Jimmy would be well off, but he was so excited to come on this trip because Gretz was in Montreal and we were in Ottawa, and he said, come on along, Jimmy, bring your boss and the other guy. And then you had said, well, we got to bring the owner, you know, and this is how excited he was, Russ. So we're in Montreal flying to LA. Okay. Uh-huh. And Gretz says, yeah, you guys can zip over here. It's about a 45-minute drive, you know, from Ottawa to Montreal.
Yeah.
So Mark invites Jimmy Waters, and Waters doesn't believe him, first of all. He says, we're going to fly in Wayne's plane. We're going to go to L.A., but Jimmy Waters was in Dallas at the time, mm-hmm. Okay? And we said, well, don't worry about that. We'll just meet you in L.A., and we'll pick you up in the morning. We're going to go golfing. Jimmy Waters goes, No, fuck that. I am flying to Montreal from Dallas.
Oh, yeah.
He flew from Dallas to Montreal.
That's great.
What and to land on this plane. And I just remember, everyone was in the cups a little bit. Yeah. And I, it's a 5-hour ride, man. This is a long taxi.
Yeah, it was great.
And I remember Jimmy Waters just getting off going, no one's going to believe me. No one will believe me.
The Gretzky effect.
The Gretzky effect. Awesome. Yeah, the Gretzky factor. Mark, absolutely. This was awesome, man. That was great.
Yeah, thanks, Mark.
Thanks a million for doing this. And it does give a lot of insight into how big this whole deal is with sports. And appreciate you coming on.
Thanks for having me, guys. It was a blast.
Yeah, thanks. And thanks for what do we do? We got to ask people to what? If they ask one person to like and share, subscribe, like, share, all that jazz.
If you like the show, you've got a friend somewhere that doesn't know about it. Let them know about it. That's how the show will grow. They'll love you for it.
If we can't get White Claw as a sponsor, we may be in trouble. So I don't know.
Let me talk to them.
Bank of Nova Scotia couldn't do it. Yeah, we need someone like you to get in there and get this thing going.
I've only had two tonight.
Yeah, well, so it makes you lie. Apparently it makes you lie, so that's good.
Have a great week, guys.
We'll talk to you later, everybody. You've been listening to The Suspendables with me, Jungle Jim Jerome, and him, Russ Cartland. We'll be back each and every week with a whole new show. Take it easy, Rusty. Have a good week.
Thanks. Thanks, Mark.
Thanks, Russ. Great, guys.
The Suspendables is a weekly hockey series with Jim Jerome in Edmonton and Russ Cortnell in L.A. Follow The Suspendables on Facebook and Twitter. Reach us at thesuspendables@yahoo.com. And, of course, we appreciate you sharing this podcast with your group of friends.